When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to CAMH.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land Shortcuts is brought to you by Squarespace. The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a unique website, showcase your work, blog, or publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code CanadaLand. You'll get 10% off of your first purchase of a website or domain. This episode is also brought to you by Sonos, who are offering listeners of this podcast 10% off of an order. And that can be up to $2,500 of Sonos gear or less. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Use the promo code CANADA10, that is CANADA10, at Sonos.com to get that offer. Sandy Garasino, columnist for Vancouver's National Observer, joining me from her vacation in Los Angeles. Hello.
Hello.
Sandy, today we are going to talk about the gay vegan Canadian who made Steve Bannon's psychological warfare tool. We are going to talk about whether or not reporting a news story meets the legal definition of harassment, and if so, can we still do it? And finally, we are going to talk about the panic over the reportedly dubious loyalties of Jagmeet Singh and other Canadian Sikh politicians. Just how afraid of them should we be? I am very glad to have you back, Sandy.
So glad to be here. Really thrilled.
This episode of Shortcuts is brought to you by Josh Clavier, Kevin Cardoza, Steve Ehrenberg, Dave Mooney, Caroline Lube Darcy, David Goforth, Tyler Rimstead, and Stephen Butler.
Because Canadaland gives me insight into Canadian media that I haven't found anywhere else.
This episode is also brought to you by Squarespace. If you're ready to start your new business, you can make it stand out with Squarespace. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers. They make it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. You can showcase your work, blog, you can publish content, you can sell products, services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from the look and feel to settings and products. It is all optimized for mobile right out of the box. You can use their amazing analytics to help you grow in real time. There is nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. If you do have a question, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer support is there to help. Destiny is calling. It says you need a new website. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, use the offer code CanadaLand. You'll get 10% off of your first purchase of a website or domain. That is squarespace.com, offer code CanadaLand.
I played a pivotal role in setting up a company that I think has done a lot of harm to the democratic process.
It was a grossly unethical experiment because you are playing with an entire country, the psychology of an entire country without their consent or awareness. And not only are you like playing with the psychology of, of an entire nation. You're playing with the psychology of an entire nation in the context of the democratic process. It was almost everything that would be on a Facebook profile. So that was things like status updates, likes, in some cases private messages.
So Cambridge Analytica has people's private messages they sent on Facebook.
I can't say whether they did or not. What I'm saying is what the app could do. It's incorrect to call Cambridge Analytica a purely sort of data science company or an algorithm, you know, company. You know, it is a full service propaganda machine. If you can control all of the streams of information around your opponent, you can influence how they perceive that battle space, and you can then influence how they're going to behave and react. If you want to fundamentally change society, you first have to break it. And it's only when you break it is when you can remold the pieces into your vision of a new society. This was the weapon that Steve Bannon wanted to build to fight his culture war.
What a nightmare.
I'll say. But all of this had been coming. I mean, in some ways, we'd had all the warning signs all the way along. And yet, here we are. And where we are is shocking.
I mean, it's shocking and unshocking. Like, I was trying to parse this morning. I mean, what do we know now? We know that the Brexit campaign and the Trump campaign and other campaigns throughout the world have been using our Facebook profiles to build psychological profiles of us, to manipulate us, to find our deepest fears and game us in order to affect political processes and subvert our democracies and elect people who were paid to manipulate us in this way. I knew that 2 weeks ago. I mean, there's nothing shocking about that. I totally knew that 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and 4 weeks ago. And yet I still feel shocked by, I don't know, the proof?
Well, what we didn't know was the data breach. We didn't know the specifics of just how bad Facebook's security over the data that it possesses is, so that somebody could get into the Facebook system, misrepresent what their purpose was and what they were doing, and gather vastly more information on vastly higher numbers of people than anyone imagined, and that Facebook was willfully blind at best, willfully blind. I've had a lot of experience with Facebook on the privacy and security side, and there comes a point where the willful blindness excuse is just a little bit too much to stomach. So there are details about the revelations here that we didn't know, and that should be concerning. And the one thing that I point to in all of this is, and nobody's yet talking about artificial intelligence. I mean, we're just looking at the tail of a comet. We don't know where this thing is going. And it's a real wake-up call for everyone.
We don't know where it's going, and we don't know the full extent of what was done. I mean, I'm still trying. I've been reading tons of this incredible journalism, and there's just so many different organizations have put so much resource into this. And yes, it seems like you would be foolish now to assume that Facebook has any control over this information, or that Cambridge Analytica were the only ones. And in fact, to their willful blindness, we're getting increased other whistleblowers, including a former Facebook higher up who says that he was warning Facebook about this. They were aware that this database had gone to Cambridge Analytica because there's a paper trail of them asking, where is that? Has it been deleted? So the extent of their blindness is hopefully going to be interrogated further. But the real bottom line here is like, okay, so we knew Facebook was doing this kind of stuff and people were, you know, doing political ads through Facebook to do exactly this kind of stuff. Now we know that it's being done off of Facebook. But what I can't figure out, Sandy, is, was this simply a matter of building psychological profiles so that we had very personalized propaganda? Or, and you bring this up through your question about artificial intelligence, am I on some Black Mirror dystopian sci-fi trip, or am I entertaining a legitimate worry when I imagine a algorithmic-based organic strain of propaganda that is not just tailoring propaganda to me, but is gaming me, is watching how I respond to things, changing the message, learning me until it finds something that I will get angry about, passionate about, and engage with and perpetuate a political message, share it, comment it? Is it like a living virus that is just going to keep chipping away at me until I do its bidding? Is that like a crazy flight of fancy? Because I can't get clarity on this as to, like, why wouldn't they be trying to do something like that?
Well, I don't think that they are yet doing that, but I have no doubt at all that the tech industry and that key developers within the tech industry would do this if they could, which is why we have to start looking at legislation. You know, I've been talking about regulating this sector since 2012, usually always on deaf ears and usually to a chorus from the tech geek world of, you are stupid, you don't know what you're talking about, you're alarmist and you don't understand technology and this is just the way it is and this is new freedom. You know, we've been sucked into a kind of utopia idea that total freedom in the tech industry is a good thing. And there's another thing that is very, very troubling here is the degree to which not just the public, but government as well, has bought the line of the tech industry that they are, you know, that they are white hats, that these are good people, they're doing good things, and that we can assign to them responsibility for creating the new moral universe. And what this has exposed is that absolutely we can't. This is a profit-driven industry. The business model is selling our data. They will get more and more and more data as much as they can. They will save as much as they can. And this is why I'm loving what the EU is bringing in, because it is really scaring the bejesus out of the tech industry. And this should become the standard across the civilized world for anybody who wants to be operating a platform on the internet, which is their general data protection regulation.
Yeah, I mean, we've covered here before just how, as this trend of cracking down on Facebook, which I hope this revelation is going to kick into overdrive, it looks like it might be doing so, just how absent from that process Canada has been and how thoroughly the Trudeau government has partnered with Facebook and given Facebook a pass and shrouded themselves in kind of tech utopian photo op glory as opposed to actually regulating them. You know, I won't pretend like it's an interesting balance to find because, again, so much of this is stuff we knew. Like the Channel 4 documentary where they went undercover and got Cambridge Analytica CEO Alexander Nix on camera saying that they will go beyond digging for dirt on political opponents. They will create dirt. They will entrap politicians with bribe offers or trying to send women and videotape it. And failing that, he says, we'll just make stuff up if we need to. I knew that kind of stuff happened in the political universe. I knew that that existed. But there's a difference between knowing that it exists and seeing proof and combining those kinds of old school oppo techniques with this terrifying Facebook database approach. It makes fools of all of us. It makes a mockery of our democracy. It is an absolute perversion of the system. And it's, you know, as individuals, we're being laughed at and played. And basically, it is now has to be recognized as fact that our freedom is sort of for sale. I mean, like, if we can't get angry about this, like, what do you get upset about, you know?
In fact, our freedom, or the freedom of many, many Americans, was sold. You know, one of the really shocking things, perhaps I'm naive, but I do think that corporations or that entities assisting campaigns that set up call girls and create the oppo material that they can then smear their opponents with, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think that that's pretty offside and that I think that this is not a widespread practice. I mean, but this is the kind of people that Donald Trump has cloaked himself with. He is surrounded by people with this kind of moral compass. So I'm not surprised at all that the Trump campaign would be using figures of this kind of ethical backbone. And I'm crossing my fingers and hoping that that's not a widespread practice, possibly naively. But I do think that.
I mean, almost as egregious as the idea that, like, maybe this process is why Trump is president or why Brexit was voted for, as bad as that is just this kind of, like, on the personal level, like, this was a campaign to divide society against itself. This was a campaign to get people to hate each other. I mean, that is so gross, you know? What do you make of Chris Wiley, the whistleblower, who is both, it seems, a pioneer of these malicious tactics and the person who we can credit for informing us that this had happened. I'm curious what you think of his media tour and the fact that there's this CP story that he was shopping similar techniques when he was like, I don't know, barely out of his teens to Ignatieff's campaign in 2009, and they told him to take a hike.
Well, I just before talking about that, I want to go back briefly to what you were mentioning before, which is that this was designed to make us all hate each other and be divisive. And in fact, there's another element to this that I think also touches on one of our later topics today, which is that social media is literally designed to heighten conflict and make people yell at each other. That anger and hatred and division and conflict are addictive for humans. We can't leave it alone. And these platforms are, like Twitter, are literally being designed to make us do that because it's part of the attention economy. There's a wonderful podcast on Sam Harris with a guy by the name of Tristan Harris, who is a design ethicist at Google and knows this whole world. And he says the back end of these platforms is unbelievable, and conflict is baked right into it. So that's just my one comment there. On Wiley, you know, how many Wileys are there? There's probably, God only knows, thousands of them. I was very interested to read an interview that The Guardian had with Alexander Kogan, who is the researcher at Cambridge, who was one of the designers of all of this technology. And in some ways, he poo-poos how accurate a lot of these algorithms are, or how accurate this targeting is. You know, it's interesting. I went on Cambridge University's site to test it, and they ran a check of my Facebook and Twitter activity, and they figured that I was a 30-year-old male, which was not accurate. So I do wonder about the accuracy of all of this. But one of the things that was really interesting that Kogan had to say was, he said, and this is in The Guardian today, and he's saying, we thought everything was fine. We think that tens of thousands of apps are doing the exact same thing that we're doing. This is a pretty normal use case of Facebook data, he says, and that we didn't think we were doing anything wrong. And I think that, you know, we can look at Wiley and we can wonder about Wiley, but there are probably tens of thousands of Wileys, and it would be wonderful if more of them had the kind of ethical lodestar, North Star, that he finally had to come forward. And, hats off to the journalists who made this happen. There's something kind of ironic about Facebook being taken down by just good old-fashioned investigative journalists like the people at Guardian, and Carol Kadwala being first among equals on that. All of this is just stunning, and it's just a gigantic wake-up call. And, you know, I've been in discussions with friends who are inside the tech industry, and in particular someone who at a very, very high level in the legal department of a major, major corporation. And I was asking this person, what does the public need to know? And this person said three things. Legislation is needed. Governments need to wake up to what these corporations are doing. That's number two. And what the business model is, understand it and not be naive about it, and trusting the technology industry to be, you know, don't be evil kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Don't trust them not to be evil. Number three, Amazon is the scariest. How do you like that?
Oh, dear God. All right. We'll leave it there, because I will hold my tongue on making a case for the amazing effects that Twitter and Facebook even has had on independent media and giving a voice to people who didn't have one before, because my timing is off for that argument. I think our takeaway needs to be, we need to do something about Facebook, because it's a power like we've never seen before. And we have an election coming up in this country, and CSIS has warned us that we're next. Okay, Sandy, I would like to talk with you a little bit about this case. It's still developing, so I don't know how deeply we can get into it, but I think it definitely bears some scrutiny. And this is the case of the Radio-Canada journalist Antoine Trepanier, who was merely investigating a story about the executive director of a charity who has an interesting past, where she conceded at some point that she practiced law without a valid license, and she's running this Big Brothers Big Sisters charity. In any event, as Trepanier pursued comment from Yvonne Dubé, And I kind of know how that goes. You say, I want to give you one more chance to comment on this. I will be publishing the story with or without your comment. I have questions for you about your past. There are accusations that have come to light. And she called the cops. She called the cops and said, I'm being harassed. And they arrested him. And it is an interesting case because the president of the Canadian Police Association chimed in, Tom Stamatakis, to say, it's almost as though the expectation is media should somehow be treated differently or have freedom to interfere with people on the basis that they are engaged in journalism. And I had, again, I can see this. But hold on. On the one hand, I'm like, that is a disgusting comment for the police to assail freedom of the press in that way. And we have always made room in especially public institutions and charities for journalists to do their job. We've always afforded them the ability to ask questions and made ourselves accountable and made public people accountable in a way that you wouldn't to just anyone. And how dare you, sir? I see that side of it. On the other hand, he's totally right. There's nothing in law. Like, if anyone else were to call someone and say, I know what you did, you have to comment or I'm going to expose you. I'm calling you again. I'm giving you one last chance. And they felt threatened or harassed, it would totally qualify potentially as threats or harassment. And there is nothing in law separating journalists from anybody in the public. And nor do I think there's
something. Oh, I'm going to break it. Excuse me. Have you heard?
Oh, shit. I'm talking to a lawyer.
The Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Yes, we have freedom. It's not particular to journalists. Everybody.
Freedom of the press is specifically protected under the Charter of Rights.
Yes.
The press,
but what is the press?
The only industry and the only segment of society that is, apart from groups that need special protection because of their status, the press is the only industry that is specifically protected because of its role in the protection of democracy. So I'm sorry. I mean, when I see this kind of thing coming from police, you know, in British Columbia, nobody's allowed to lay charges until the Crown Council, actual lawyers who have heard of and read the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and understand it and understand the law, have a look at it, and then charges get filed. You know, this case to me, there should be some sort of legal mind supervising the laying of charges. There is an absurdity here. It is wrong.
Oh, Counselor, I it is absolutely wrong, and I will not defend the police actions. And God help me if I open up some kind of J-school or philosophical debate about this that I can't get out of and I'm ill-equipped to defend myself on. But come on. Okay, we can agree that Radio Canada reporter, that's the press, right?
Yes.
If a citizen with a blog in that community, and more local journalism in this country is being done by citizens with blogs or Twitter accounts, were to ask the same questions, are they press? I mean, you keep referring to the industry, and I think the law is very fuzzy on what the press is and whether you need to be industrialized or professionalized by some unknown standard in order to have those types of protections afforded to you. This has happened on an ad hoc basis where it was really clear who was a reporter. It's not so clear anymore, and I am worried about an increased ability for people to sick the cops on people who are doing journalism in anything but the most sanctioned, professionalized kind of capacity.
Well,
I mean, is that not a valid part of this?
At the same time, I have seen and know of cases where bloggers have, you know, really, really pursued people far, far beyond what is rational because reporters and journalists have professional standards. They abide by a code of ethics. There is some degree of professional. There is a degree of professionalism there. And we have seen the risks of just, you know, handing anybody that kind of stature and rebel media. But
so many people would cough and say Canada Land with the same breath, you know? So many people would cough and say, like, oh my God, I've done it. How do we get out of this?
I almost
want to ask you if you think we should be licensed, but I'm not going to because I'm afraid of what you're going
to
say.
But okay, let's just take it back to, again, this legal case, because Ms. Dubé seems to be a little bit adept at gaming the legal system. She seems to have run into trouble for passing herself off as a lawyer. She has been permanently enjoined from engaging in the unauthorized practice of law. You know, this is somebody who kind of knows their way around the system a little bit here. And even given the circumstances of this case, which is a call and an email asking for an interview, this is not criminal harassment. Period.
No argument. Let's end it at yes. I agree.
Yeah.
Sandy, I'm going to thank our second sponsor, and that is FreshBooks. If you are a freelancer, if you are a small business owner, it's that time of year. It is tax season. There's a good chance that you are dealing with some headaches right now, dealing with a box of receipts, dealing with all of your papers and emails and invoices, and everything is scattered and you've got to dig it all up, enter it in, make sense of it. It is a time suck. Why not do yourself a favor and stop digging? Before you completely disappear under all of that paperwork, check out FreshBooks cloud accounting software. Not only is it going to save you a ton of time and stress now and throughout the year, it might actually change the way you feel about dealing with your taxes. Need to send your accountant a quick summary on the amount of tax that you've collected last year? Do you need to pull together a profit and loss summary? FreshBooks can generate those reports with the click of a button instead of the hours that it would take you, puny human. You can even set up FreshBooks to import expenses directly from your bank accounts, which means that the next time you use your debit card for a work-related expense, boom, it is recorded instantly in FreshBooks. You get all of that. And also, FreshBooks is stupid easy to use. It is made especially for people like me who don't like dealing with numbers or their taxes. Right now, FreshBooks is offering a 30-day free trial, no credit card required, for people who listen to this podcast. If you want that, go to freshbooks.com/CanadaLand and enter CanadaLand in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Sandy, I want to duly note a few things with you. Can we duly note?
Yeah.
I have a couple, so I'll go first, and I want to, actually, it's related to what we were just talking about. I want to point out that in the town of Pelham, Ontario, local officials have just stopped responding to journalists. They've just stopped sending, there's one news outlet in town, the Pelham Voice, and for several weeks, the town councilors, public officials, just stopped sending press releases, stopped answering calls, stopped answering questions, and the Canadian Association of Journalists, to their credit, have taken up this case and said you cannot ignore local journalists and is shaming town council. But I want to kind of just lend my voice to that public shaming, because we're going to see more of this as local journalistic outfits disappear and weaken. You're going to see a direct correlation where elected officials are just going to start to say, well, maybe I don't have to be accountable to these people or this local blogger. Maybe I can ignore this. And we just need to constantly push back against that.
And there's going to be more and more pressure, especially at the local and municipal level, where so much of the journalism has just eroded to the breaking point. And I don't think that there's much negative political consequences for that. And it's really concerning. Duly noted.
Sandy, what have you for us?
Well, we're in BC, and so we're watching the unfolding of Kinder Morgan pipeline is heating up, and there's a lot of controversy back and forth. And one of the things that the media is it's starting to appear in the media amongst reporters who are effectively expressing their opinion. There's this drumbeat starting that the environmental opposition and First Nation opposition to the pipeline is being foreign funded. And there's getting to be this whole concern that somehow that's illegitimate. And that this is actually being expressed by a lot of people in the media and journalism as a means of discrediting the opposition. Now, whichever way you come down on this pipeline, I am concerned about, especially when media and journalists start to suggest that there's something illegitimate about an environmental group getting funding from a large major international philanthropic foundation to stop. And the Kinder Morgan its parent company is an American, it's basically an American pipeline company, and it's going to be serving largely foreign owned oil and gas companies and oil and gas interests to sell Canadian oil to foreign countries to get foreign money. But somehow all of a sudden it's totally not on for the environmentalists to avail themselves of globalization the way that industry has. So my duly noted is maybe we should be a little bit more skeptical about this.
Duly noted. Finally, I just want to point out something really cool. Reporter Zane Schwartz, who is a post-media journalist who's been on a fellowship, spent his fellowship gathering 6 million records from every province and territory and has created something called Follow the Money, which is Canada's first central searchable database of political donations. You can just Google this, Postmedia Follow the Money, and you could find out who has given money, what organizations have given money, and to whom. And you can do that in reverse. This is an incredible resource that will fuel not just a greater public awareness of who's paying for what, but it'll help journalists do their jobs. It's the kind of thing we need more of. So kudos to Zane Schwartz, and check it out. It's really cool. Follow the money.
Duly noted.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses. But we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
Well, last topic today, Sandy, I want to update people on where this Khalistani in Canada story has gone since we last spoke about it. I will attempt a bit of a summary. The Globe and Mail revealed that Jagmeet Singh, in fact, has ties to Sikh separatism beyond what was previously known. Among them, he attended a rally in San Francisco in 2015 honoring Sikh separatist Jamail Singh Bhindranwale. And this series of revelations, that wasn't the only one, linking Jagmeet Singh in various ways to this cause, have finally resulted in Jagmeet Singh taking a more definitive stand on this than he was previously in his infamous interview with Terry Molesky when he was first named leader of the NDP. And he has since denounced Parmar. He accepts the findings that Parmar is the architect of the Air India bombing. He has said that these questions are fair. And this has led to another round of coverage, which is where our focus should be, including a column in the Globe and Mail by Margaret Wente, the headline of which is "The Strange Loyalty of Jagmeet Singh." Marty Patrickwin, writing in iPolitics, says that this calls into question Singh's own contention about his very identity, that it is based on peace between Hindus and Sikhs, that is now called into question. And Marty describes Jagmeet Singh as a quote, "a brown-skinned man in a turban and an impeccably tailored suit. Singh strikes a perfect balance between exoticism and familiarity." And Marty goes on to write that Jagmeet Singh should cop to his religious convictions. So that's happening, and that is how Jagmeet Singh is being described by certain members of the press. On the other side, to a much quieter degree from the fringes, we have the Georgia Strait, their editor Charlie Smith, writing a piece, the headline of which was, "Let's expose mainstream media nonsense about NDP leader Jagmeet Singh." Singh is as Canadian as anyone else, writes Smith. And he says, look, this is political. Both the Conservative and Liberal Party have an interest in painting Singh as the other, a man to be feared because he's going to import foreign disputes onto Canadian soil and undermine our relations with India. And the mainstream media, I think Smith suggests, is being complicit in this political campaign. And, you know, he doesn't want to attribute all of this to racism on the part of Canadian journalists. But he writes, many of these media people cannot be simply written off as racist. They don't carry hatred in their hearts. They're just ignorant and lacking in curiosity. Sandy, you've written about this too. Where do you fall on this? Because I can see both sides to this.
Well, I think that, first of all, the degree to which this is a major inflammation is really unfortunate, because I think what it plays to is public fears, fear of terrorism. I think that's probably the number one thing that the average Canadian who, you know, gets just slivers of news and information. And I worry about the impact. I always look at these things from the perspective, okay, when parents are reading and getting just a little bit of information, what are their kids doing to other kids in the schoolyard? You know, are kids going to be being bullied because they are wearing Sikh or Muslim headgear or something like that? That's kind of a little bit of my litmus test. And I feel like the inflammation here has been not well informed. And I think that there has been a lot of driving of fear. Here's the number one thing that Canadians need to know, which is that the Sikh civil conflict that happened in Punjab, and there was a huge conflagration there in the early 80s to the early 90s, and it did take lives. There was terrorism, and there was a lot of violence, Sikhs would say, and the historical record seems to underscore this, that it was violence against Sikhs that was the main driver of this insurgency and of this violence. And the violence peaked in about 1991 at up to 5,000 deaths were recorded in that year on both sides of the conflict. That conflict ended as a major public safety concern by 1994. And that is widely accepted by national security experts. You know, the piece that I did, I looked not at what, you know, various people in this community or that community might have to say about each other. I looked at, well, what do the experts say? And what's the official position? What's the consensus? The consensus is that this is over as a public safety issue. And there has been a conflation in the media, I would say generally, and generally by people outside the Sikh community, that anyone looking to be a separatist is also a terrorist. There's no foundation to that. There's no foundation to that. But an awful lot of the movement is about social justice, because there were terrible, terrible crimes committed against the Sikhs. And there was a reign of terror. Thousands and thousands of Sikhs were killed and slaughtered. And something that we don't talk about, because when you hear people talk about what happened to their family, they will talk about an uncle that was killed or somebody in their family that was murdered, usually a man. I'm going to say this. There were thousands and thousands of rapes of women. Gang rapes in some cases, in front of their children. So this is something that is very hard for a lot of people who are from this community, and they can't talk about that. But it's very hard for a lot of people from this community to then, you know, hear from the media that they should just walk away from this, that they should not be concerned about it. You know, there are a lot of communities. We come, all of us, except for First Nations, from somewhere else. And the international environment, it's now global. Look at Ukraine, look at Chechnya and Russia. There are people who are concerned about what's going on in the home communities of their heritage. There's another aspect to this that I think that Canadians should understand, and also that Sikhs here, especially the millennials who seem to be very, very engaged in this, is that there isn't any real possibility of Sikh or Khalistan independence. That's just a non-starter. Sikhs comprise less than 2% of the Indian population, and their dominant area is Punjab, which is located right on the Pakistan border. India will never permit independence there. So the concerns have to be about human rights. They have to be about democratic principles. And I would just finish off with one thing about this Bindranwali figure. If as it's claimed, that the lionization of Bindranwali, who was killed during an Indian government attack on the holiest shrine in the Sikh religion, the Golden Temple of Amritsar, if he was really being lionized as a violent figure, which is what is stated, and he did have a violent background and was no angel, if that's his appeal, then where has the violence been? The people who are talking about this issue, the Sikhs, are talking about justice. They're not talking about, well, let's go organize a terrorist attack. There hasn't been a terrorist attack of any significance in over 20 years. So I just think all of this is, we're looking at the wrong thing. I think we're looking at this wrong, and we should be more curious about what's really going on inside the community, because this is not a community that's a terrorist community. This is not ISIS, and they're being treated as if they are.
Wow. This is, you know, this runs deep, and that was only a fraction of what you covered in your piece, which I think is so far the definitive explainer for this in the National Observer, your piece about the context, which also goes into the current political climate in India and Modi's government and how Canada is being used as a pawn. People should read this. The big points to me are, like, you would not know from this campaign about Singh, this line of inquiry and the editorials based on it, that there has not been violence in 20 years. You would not know the distinctions of that violent separatism from, which isn't really a thing anymore, from people who still are sympathetic to the idea of Khalistani separatism and just how completely separate those things are, and that those things are separate from just being Sikh in general. That gets lost in the shuffle, and your concern for the community as a whole, who, for reasons you cite, may not feel comfortable talking about this. And you point out in your piece that there are people who are talking about this who are not heard as loudly as some of the mainstream journalists, veteran journalists, who are kind of claiming the story because they were central to reporting on the Air India bombing. And, you know, and I guess I'm, I don't have any of them on this week either, but you point to Supriya Dwivedi, and writing for Global News, and the UK writer Sunny Hundal, who writes for iPolitics, and Jagdish Mann, who writes for Vancouver's Georgia Strait. So I think you make really, really good points that are obscured by a lot of what's going on. And all of that being said, I don't even think it's like the other side of this. I think that both things can be true. I do think that if Jagmeet Singh wants to be prime minister, then the cagey way that he has tried to kind of walk a line and not be completely forthcoming about everything is certainly fair game, as I've said from the start, for journalists to inquire about. And it is a good thing that we now know where he stands. I think it's possible to be critical and skeptical about the lack of context provided and not put up any blockades or shame any journalists for asking questions, which I think there's no reason not to ask them. They should be asked.
I think that's absolutely true. That, you know, especially given the context of the Air India bombing. And let's make this absolutely clear. The Air India bombing was conducted by people in extremists in British Columbia. There's no question about that. To a certain extent, the degree to which people are being fuzzy about it, they're kind of like, you know, 9/11 truthers in some way. I think that a lot of them, they're not terrorist apologists. They mistakenly believe that there was a frame-up job. I don't believe that for a minute. I think it's been very, very clearly established. And Singh should have been crystal clear on that right from day one. And he should have also anticipated that that was going to be a question based on his previous political activity. So it's not like there's no justification at all for asking these questions and for being quite tough. My concern about how the questions were originally asked was that it would have been good for Canadians to see the setup, to see, well, what's the context of this question? Are you asking this man about this because he's brown, or what's the reality? That we've learned a lot more in the days since, months since.
You're referring to the lack of context in the Terry Maleski interview?
The original Terry Maleski interview where the question was raised, but it seemed to, for me, come out of nowhere. And I think for most Canadians, it came out of nowhere, for the simple reason that all politicians of all political parties go to these temples.
Yeah. You know, Sandy, since you bring it up, maybe you can join me down a rabbit hole here. And actually, we've had a wonderful episode of Shortcuts, and we could just stop here. And if people are not interested in my Twitter conflicts, they can go ahead and turn this off right here. But Sandy, I respect the hell out of you. as a journalist, as a legal mind, as a person with incredible context and insight and good judgment, can I ask you for some life coach advice on my troubles with Terry? Is that appropriate? Can we talk about that for a second?
Maybe. What's your
question? Look, I would rather talk to Terry about this, but he won't come on the show. Okay, here are some words that Terry has used in his, I think at this point, hundreds of tweets towards me. Here are some words he's used to describe this podcast, my tweets, or me as a human being. Icky, nasty, creepy, slimy, slippery, smear artist, loony, pathetic, dumb, a dunce, sophomoric, spews terrorist propaganda, glorifies a terrorist, idolizes a mass murderer, fraudulent, a liar. And I don't know what to do with this guy. I will try to summarize this as fairly as possible. Of course, it's problematic for me to be the one summarizing. I'd rather he was here to present his side of it. But I brought up the concern you brought up when that interview happened. I said, he's right to ask those questions, but there wasn't enough context given. And when I had that conversation on this show with Omar Mualim, Omar said, well, the context that was lacking was that it's hard for Jagmeet Singh to denounce Parmar. And I've asked some people in the Sikh community about this because Parmar's guilt is a contentious subject. He was tortured. Did he confess under torture? And it's just for Singh to denounce him may have cost him some support within the Sikh community. And Omar was not taking a side on that. He was just saying this is why it might have been hard for Jagmeet Singh. That is, as I understand it, why Terry Molesky feels that I spew terrorist propaganda, or my podcast spews terrorist propaganda, that merely presenting Parmar in that light and providing that context is essentially giving a glorification or excuses for him. And to me, the question is, and why he won't come on the show is because he's demanding an apology because he contends that I called him a racist. I hope this isn't too schoolmarmish. What I said is that in not providing that context and aggressively coming at Jagmeet Singh with that question again and again and again, it seems to me just a matter of fact that Terry looked like a racist to a lot of people. A lot of people thought it was racist to interrogate Jagmeet Singh that way. And I immediately said, I think there's probably more to this, so let's get some additional context. I believe that Terry Molesky's position is that there is no difference between saying you looked like a racist and it was reasonable for people to take you for a racist. There's no difference between doing that and saying, dude, you are a racist. I disagree with that. I think that those are two different statements with two different interpretations. I would be happy to have that debate with him. He doesn't want to have that debate. He's told me to get lost. And yet, while he's told me to leave him alone, he keeps peppering me with these insults, which I can take the icky, nasty, creepy. But when he calls me a liar or fraudulent from his CBC Terry account to his 85 plus thousand followers, I don't know what to do anymore with this guy. Do you have any advice for me?
Well, since you asked, well, look at what I just said about, you know, way at the beginning of this podcast, where I talked about how this platform is designed to inflame this kind of division. You know, the one side is tossing the racism accusation and the other side is tossing the terrorism accusation. And it's just, it's like both sides are talking past each other. And I'm not just talking about you, Jesse, or just about Terry. But what's gone missing here is a belief in the good faith of the other party. Obviously, Terry Molesky, and there are other journalists who I think fall into this camp, feel that their integrity is being questioned, and they're responding very, very vigorously. And at the same time, a lot of Sikhs are feeling that their good faith and integrity is being really questioned by the assumption that anytime they speak out to defend the community's position, that they're glorifying terrorism. I just think that the rhetoric here has gone way off, and I'm not sure at this point whether anybody can back down. It was very interesting to see Sunny Hundal had, where's that National Post thing? He had...
I believe that was Sunny Hundal, who was engaging with Maura Forrest of the National Post.
And they actually personally engaged. And I think that they did that in a way that started with the assumption of good faith. You know, as emotions climb in all of these things, I think this is one of those situations, I hope it is, that people will look back on as events kind of, other events kind of eclipse this story. And think, oh, you know, I got really wound up there. I just don't think Twitter is the place for these discussions once people start throwing bombs on either side. I think I really wish, and I wish so much, that people would just please go back to the facts. Start yeah. with the facts, because so much of this is being driven by fear. Some kind of fear underlies this, fear of six, fear that there's going to be some kind of terrorism. And it makes me want to weep, because that's like being afraid of the FLQ at this point.
Well, you know, I am a believer, perhaps Pollyanna-ish, in this medium, even above Twitter, on just conversation. And you know, my offer stands. He won't do it until I apologize. You know, you could beat me with a hose until I apologize, and, you know, you could get the apology out of me. I can't apologize for calling him a racist because I didn't call him one. But I'll talk with him anywhere, on this show, on his show, in front of an audience, in private. The offer stands. If he keeps coming at me, I don't know what I can do. But thank you for your thank you for your good counsel today, Sandy.
There's a mute button.
I could just mute Terry. I've never muted anybody. I've never blocked anybody. But there is a mute button. That is your Canada Land Shortcuts. You can email me about it, anybody, at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send me. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Sandy, where can people find you?
On Twitter at Garasino and in the National Observer, where I'm a regular columnist.
And you should go check her out there. Our website is canadalandshow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. This episode was produced by David Crosby. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. And if you like what we do, please support us on Patreon.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.